So I am so grateful to be here this Sunday. I've grown to love this space very much. I've had this relationship with Beit HaGivot, now the Jewish congregation that meets here, for 18 months. I've been their spiritual leader, and they will continue to meet here, even though I am moving shortly to Northern California to be closer to my family. And I love that this space has been a place where so many different communities are able to offer up their prayers and celebrate holidays and find solace with each other. And we have all of you to thank for that. Before coming here, I worked for several congregations who were in the process of acquiring new buildings or building larger additions to their space. And so I'm very well aware of the amount of effort and time and energy it takes to do that. And so we really appreciate the fact that you've done that work and we're able to share in that fruit of the work that you've done. So thank you. So I wanted to share with you this morning two things. Actually, part of it came from what I had written 6 months ago, but as I've changed and grown, there was more I wanted to say. But there's been a particular thought that I learned about a year ago that has really inspired me, and I love to be inspired and to share any piece of interesting information with as many people as I can. I'm in the right profession. And the other piece of idea and information I want to share is relatively new to me. It's just something that I studied with my congregation on Yom Kippur, which was only a few weeks ago. And so this is something I'm currently excited about and still working on in my mind. And I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to deepen my understanding of it by sharing it with you. So this first wonderful, exciting idea for me stems from our shared creation story, the beginning of the beginning of both Judaism and Christianity. This piece of Deuteronomy that we just looked at is from the very last portion of the five books of Moses. And in the Jewish tradition, we read those five books of Moses in order from beginning to end in the course of a year. So we are just, that is the piece that in every Jewish congregation this weekend, yesterday and the day before, they would have read. And this coming week, we would read the very first chapter of Genesis, which we call Bereshit, which also means in the beginning. It's probably the closest of the two names. Genesis and Bereshit actually have a similar meaning. For all of the other books, it doesn't line up that way. Numbers is Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness, because that's the beginning of that book. But the story that I want to talk to you about begins with this creation story and talks about how to pull a new understanding out of it to give us some direction on the future of our creation, the future of our creative power. So last January, I saw one of my favorite rabbis. His name is Yitz Greenberg. I'm a little bit of a groupie. He spoke at a congregation in Scottsdale, and I've seen him many times, and I'm a follower of his work. He's the founder of an organization called Klal, which means all of us, which is a leadership training institute that really focuses on pluralism. And he's written some really foundational books on Jewish spirituality and religious life and interfaith dialogue. I think he also traveled with a group of interfaith leaders to go see the Dalai Lama in Tibet, and there's some writing about that he's done. And so I wanted to share with you this one thought that he had left me with this year. So in Genesis, we have the divine transformation of chaos into order. What existed in the world, what the Torah says, is that this is called tohu vavohu, a state of formlessness and void, commotion and confusion and chaos. And from this chaos, order was created. So from this story, we receive our first primary direction, in general, to create order out of chaos. And we see the creation of this planet as an intentional, purpose-laden action that, you know, religion allows us to believe that this earth and our lives on it are not accidental or haphazard. They're intentional and deliberate creations by a force who longs to love its creation and say that it is good, as it does in the story of creation. So at the beginning of the story, we have order, but we don't quite have any moving life yet, right? So life does not arrive until the fifth day of creation. Day one, we have light. Day two, we have the sky and the land. Day three, we have the ocean and the seas and the plants and the trees, things that aren't, you know, animal-like. Day four, we have sun and moon and stars. And it's not until day five that we have the creatures of the sea. And day six, when we have all the animals of the land and the humans. So what is this first thing that we learn about ourselves in the creation story? Genesis chapter 1, line 26 says, "Vayomer Elohim na'aseh Adam b'tzalmo." And God said, "Let us make people in our image." And the next line says, "And in the image of God, God created them male and female." So this very thing, first thing that we know about ourselves is that we are made in the image of God. The phrase in Hebrew is called b'tzalem Elohim. We are in the image of God, both male and female. So we can imagine for a moment that this is the only thing that we knew about human beings, right? The only thing that we know about human beings is that they are made in the image of God. And from this belief, we derive the idea that each and every human being has absolute infinite value, every one of them. You know, I'm not a math person. I can't even count. So infinity is probably my favorite number, right? So 1 times infinity is infinity. You know, 7 billion times infinity is still infinity. And if I had to sum up my entire religious belief system in one phrase, it would probably be that this is a system that helps us understand and respect and demonstrate our own and each other's infinite value. So, but the tricky thing is that we are a creation that changes as we grow. Another favorite rabbi of mine, Rabbi David Wolpe, who's at Temple Sinai in Los Angeles, he said recently in a sermon, "To love a book or a movie or a painting is to love something that will stay exactly the same as you grow in your love for it. But to love a person is to make a pact to grow." Or it's not love. Because if you love a person, they are going to change. So for us to continue to love them, we have to change too. So one of the things I don't think we talk about enough is that this is also an aspect of being in the image of God. We've for a long time relied on the somewhat incorrect translation of God's own name. So a lot of us have read the translation in the Bible that God's name is I am what I am. And this name makes God sound very fixed. God is, and this is what God is. But in the original Hebrew, the text says something else. So, and you have to appreciate people who have the patience and the dedication to translate books. It's a very challenging and painstaking task. But there's an Italian proverb that says any translation is a betrayal. So in translation, there's some loss often. So the passage of the Bible where Moses confronts God in the burning bush, Moses asks, "If I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The Elohim, the God of your ancestor, has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is this God's name?' what should I say to them?" And this God said to Moses, "Echya asher echya." And a more accurate translation of the phrase "Echya asher echya" is "I am becoming what I am becoming." The verb "Echya" is not static. It's not present tense. It's in the progressive form. It is in the becoming form, not in the "I am" form. So what we know first about ourselves is that we are in the image of God. And what we know first about God is that God becomes, God grows, and just as much so do we grow. So just add one more layer to this discussion. You know, we often use the parental relationship as a metaphor for our relationship with God. We are born completely open, imprintable, unaware, and we grow into a greater awareness of ourselves and the world, and hopefully greater ethical behavior. So as children, we need our parents to give us strict regulation and guidelines of what is right and wrong, very defined rules, and sometimes even punishments. But as we grow older, parental guidance relaxes. And as we move through adulthood, we ask our parents for advice and support, but not that same kind of structure. So the Jewish community has the benefit of having this particular relationship with God for at least 3,000 years, calling ourselves a Jewish people. And this is the year in the Jewish calendar of 5773. So we believe that the story of creation of ourselves as humans goes back almost 6,000 years. So we have this very long-standing relationship with God. And in this relationship with this God who is I am becoming what I am becoming, this dynamic relationship where both of us have chosen to grow, Rabbi Greenberg's suggestion is that in this relationship, we are no longer children or infants, that we are now progressing towards adulthood. And as adults, we don't expect our parents to rush in and miraculously rescue us every time we're in trouble. No, just like our parents may have swept in to save us as children, as we grow, they naturally relinquish control and allow us to make our own decisions and mistakes. We're now in a time where God may feel more hidden in the background, and allowing us to take more of a new license on our own spiritual maturity, where we can act accountable for our own actions and slowly grow into this image of God. Just as each of us as children hope to grow up to be in the image of our mentors or our heroes or our teachers or our parents, all the adults who surround us, so too as spiritual beings, we grow up into this image of God. We are now the ones that we've been waiting for. There are certainly people in the world who are not necessarily ready for this type of responsibility. And they long for the religious experience of all the restrictions that you would place on a child. They want to see God as fixed as I am. And sometimes talk about, well, if we assumed the restrictions that we had in olden days, then maybe this God of miracles would become more visible and overprotective as in the days before our spiritual maturity. If we return to stricter gender roles or certain dietary restrictions or specific, personal behaviors, maybe then this visible, structured God would return. Others will see the lack of this overprotective divine presence as the lack of any God at all. If God is more hidden, allowing us to take on more responsibility and shoulder more risk, maybe God never existed. If I can't see that structure now, maybe it never existed. And in the cycle of the Jewish holidays, there's a demonstration of this. So I brought some of the symbols of Sukkot because we're currently in Sukkot, and I will talk about Sukkot at the end as sort of an aside. and Sukkot is one of the oldest Jewish holidays. It's in the five books of Moses. But the most modern of all Jewish holidays is still based on the Bible. But it's called Purim, and we celebrate it in the spring. And it's based on the book of Esther. And what's interesting about the book of Esther, where this woman is able to have the bravery to save the entire Jewish people, God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. God is hidden and allows the people in that story to express their own spiritual maturity, to stand up and be the ones who rescue their own people. Just as a parent who respects their adult children gives them the space to make their own decisions and prove that they are able to practice what they've learned from their parents. God's perceived absence is actually an invitation to be called to action for us. So this is not God being absent. It is God inviting us to step up and partner in repairing the injustice in the world. So how do we know how to take on that responsibility? How do we know how to be spiritually mature? During the high holidays, we had a short study session in between services. And during the study session, we talked about one of our great spiritual teachers, guilt. So now, unfortunately, I don't believe that guilt has been given its rightful credit as a spiritual teacher, because it's usually seen as sort of a negative end result. I did this or I did that, and I don't feel so good, so I feel guilty. And it's guilt that stays with us, even when we forget what the original source of the guilt ever was. And we sometimes act as if guilt itself is an action, and we should deserve some credit for it. You know, at least I feel guilty. Right? And I believe that this is because we understand what guilt is. Even a little kid, you know, I was supposed to do this, and I know I feel guilty. You know, we understand what guilt feels like. But through my conversation with my congregants in the study session, I started thinking of guilt as something else, as a waste product of another emotion, another feeling that we don't necessarily have language for. So just as a child develops and grows a more expansive vocabulary to demonstrate their maturity, we as spiritually evolving and maturing people need to constantly enhance our vocabulary in order to express ideas and fully understand more complex thoughts. One of the things I was thinking is one of the ways we can try to do that is learning other languages, because sometimes there is a word for something in another language that we don't have in this language, and so it adds to the complexity of our ability to think about things. I know you've talked a lot about Ubuntu in this congregation, and that's a way of adding thoughts and language from other cultures to sort of add to our toolbox. But sometimes we still have to create more language so that we have a greater understanding and we can continue to mature. So guilt is never the first actor in a situation. You can't feel guilty unless a series of other things has happened, right? So you observed something or were aware of something, you had several choices, and you chose one, you didn't like that choice, or you chose to do nothing, right? And so what we do is we call this process that eventually arrives somewhere as guilt. You know, if we see someone on the side of the street asking for change or for help, and we walk past, but we have an emotional response, therefore, we have guilt. But there's something that exists before the guilt, right? And through the conversation with my congregants, we started calling this something else, this humanitarian impulse, right? This empathic humanitarian impulse. There is an intent that arises from your highest self. And when you don't listen to it, or when you only see it after the fact and, you know, that it could have gone better, then that creates a waste product of guilt. So this is the education that guilt provides. And even though we often respond to guilt as some kind of like unwanted visitor rather than a teacher. I've told this story before, one of the situations where I feel like someone was able to respond presently to this humanitarian impulse was Mayor Cory Booker. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's the mayor of Newark. And sometime this year, he was in a situation where there was literally a building burning. And even though his security guys were like, "You're the mayor of Newark, you know, the fire department will be here soon," he rushed in there and saved a woman from the building. So that was a situation where instead of saying, "I'm the mayor of Newark, what am I going to do? I'm not a firefighter, I can't do anything," and then feeling guilty about it later, he just acted on that initial humanitarian impulse. And he went there, and both of them were safe, and it turned out for the best. So now in this process, when I feel that twinge of guilt, instead of being upset or doing something to try to make myself just feel better, I try to trace it back. You know, what was this humanitarian impulse trying to say that I could have done a little bit differently to create a different result? Is there a higher road I could have taken? And can I remind myself to think about this lesson next time I'm in the same situation? Another interesting framework that I heard recently came from the founder of Amazon, named Jeff Bezos. He was talking on an interview about how he made the decision to leave his awesome job on Wall Street and start Amazon in 1994. And he called that process that he went to regret minimization. He said, you know, when he started thinking about what he should do, he imagined that he was in his 80s and thinking back on his life and thinking about how he could minimize the regrets that he would have when he would reflect back. And he came up with the idea that he didn't think he would regret trying this idea, even if it didn't work. He didn't think he would regret even failing at it. But the one thing that he would regret was not trying. You know, he thought, you know, even if I can't do this, you know, I'd rather try and know that I've tried than have to hold the regret or the guilt of not having the courage to do that. And this helped him create a decision that felt very clear and very easy for him. And so he put language, he put the, you know, regret minimization framework, he put that language on trying to understand how his spirit works in the world. You know, his spirit that had this intention to provide books for everyone, anywhere, everywhere, all over the world. And if he had put this intention, this impulse, right, this sweet, juicy idea, if he had put this up on a shelf and forgotten about it, it could have easily become the sour, you know, puckering vinegar of guilt or regret. So we have to think about, you know, do we want to take to sip, you know, this fresh impulse, or do we want to put this on the shelf and see and take the risk of it going bad? So to go back to the original thought, as people who have evolved into a mature relationship with God, a God who trusts our own instincts, a God who trusts our understanding to make the right choices, to know when to ask for help, and to know when to contemplate within ourselves if we truly already know what's right within us, you know, we need to step into this understanding with a sense of faith, to take on this responsibility of being mature, co-creative people who are in a relationship with God, with a God who asks us to analyze our actions, to minimize our regrets, to start listening to our humanitarian impulse, to understand the direction of our highest self, so that ignoring it doesn't lead to the guilt or the regret that for Jews we come here in Yom Kippur and we say, we're sorry. But our God does not want us to feel guilty, right? Any more than a healthy parent would want us to feel guilty. God wants to grow into our own maturity, to see ourselves as powerful agents of creativity and change, and understand what a gift and a responsibility is to be made in the image of God. So may we all be blessed to step up to this challenge with courage and with gratitude. May you have a good week. Amen.